Well, maybe we could start again. I said that Tony, as one of the members of the task force, might like to comment on David's ideas. So, Tony, if you would like to, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's difficult to sit here. I haven't read either of the papers except for listening to Mr. Johnson and Mr. Case. But basically, it seems to me, in addition to the discussions that have been going on concerning the, I think what it is the desires of people to govern themselves locally in relation to the federal or state governments, as well as with other local governments around them, there's been a lot of discussion that we've listened to, the task force has listened to in the last month, from people in the villages, people that represented different governmental organizations as well as individual organizations. The discussions basically from the villages are quite simple, and they are that we want locally controlled, we want a locally controlled form of government. What shape that takes doesn't seem to quite matter when you get to the specifics. What is probably more important to the local village governments is, in fact, that the governing powers by the local governments be internal to the village, internal to the community, and that it work in relation to both the federal and state governments. So that from my perspective, at least, my preliminary perspective in from the task force is that the problem doesn't seem to be within the village in terms of what they want for local governing powers. The power seems to be with the state and federal governments recognizing that local governments can in fact govern themselves. And that's probably a more difficult concept from the legal standpoint of the state of Alaska trying to give certain powers, sometimes undefined powers, to local governments. If in fact the state legislature can't see its way through passing the mostly technical revisions of Title 29, the municipal code, I hardly expect that the state legislature would be willing to grant limited or unlimited powers to local governments other than what are defined in Title 29. So from my perspective, it's a matter of a political decision that's probably more difficult to make than the practical aspects of giving local powers to local governments for specific purposes. There arise a lot of questions, at least in my mind, throughout the hearings that we've had, and basic to a lot of the testimony is, in fact, the practical responsibilities of that local government to its citizenry. How that translates into the state looking at a local government and saying, what benefits are you going to give your citizens? I don't know the answer to that. And we've not gotten a clear answer from the general public, nor from any state institution, what the answer to that question is. I think there's a lot of fear on the part of non-Native members when they look at a Native community. And I think Mr. Case is right. It's sometimes difficult to understand the analysis that people like him go through in analyzing the local governments and what it is that they want. The discussion so far today brings to mind one question, and that is, in my mind, and that is, while we get a brief glimpse of what is happening to the Aborigines in Australia, and a brief look as to what's happening in Canada, how might those examples be applicable to the state of Alaska when in fact we can't identify specifically the actual differences between the Alaska Native experience and local governments and the Native Americans' experience in the lower 48? As far as the historical sequence that was given by Mr. Case, about termination and what that meant and its applicability to Alaska Natives, when I don't know what the discussion was that he had with Ada Deer, but I would ask a question of Mr. Case, and that is, in a termination, what gets terminated and then restored? I don't know the answer to that question. And I don't know the answer to the question of whether, in fact, we can identify sovereignty in its ideal form in the state of Alaska and apply it to local native governments and how they might exercise local control in a fast-changing world. And I stated in that way only because the influences on those communities by the state, whether it's influx of oil money going into those communities in capital projects or revenue sharing or municipal assistance, and how the local governments might deal with identifiably public monies. And that's basically how the state has viewed those public monies going into the local governments. As far as the different jurisdictions are concerned, it's probably easier to identify the powers of a local government in criminal law, and admittedly I know less about that than either Mr. Case or Mr. Johnson. But basically I view the villages wanting to take control of that aspect of their lives as well as other aspects. And the comments that we've heard from many, many people point out many examples of how, in fact, they can control their own lives in relation to what responsibilities both the state and federal governments have. I'll stop there. I probably can ramble all day, but I'll stop there.
There was a question about the Menominees, what gets terminated and what gets restored. I think that really should have been directed to you, Ralph. Do you want to just answer that?
I'd like to defer to Charles Wilkinson, who participated actively in the Menominee restoration. Why don't you comment, Charles, on what was the status of the Menominees after restored?
Just like to say that I really am honored to be included in this. I'd wanted to come up on two earlier occasions and had scheduling conflicts and that I couldn't break. It seems to me that even in the lower 48 states, many, many people involved in this field would consider what this commission is doing to be perhaps the most vital and progressive movement in Indian policy today, and I congratulate you for that. It's nice to be dealing with a commissioner whose most controversial policy is his coffee break policy. I represented the Menominees as a lawyer in the passage of the Menominee Restoration Act, which went through in 1973. I know Ada Deer was here earlier, and I really think before talking, and I won't go on at too much length, I'll take questions if anyone has them, but I think rather than mentioning specifics on that bill first, I think I'll mention a general point, which is that to almost astounding degree, Menominee restoration was what the Menominees wanted it to be. And it seems to me that's a concept that Alaska Natives need to be working with all the way through this process. What is practical and what works is what will happen, but you must start first with your dream. You must clearly have in mind what you believe is right and then work back to the practical. I think it's much too easy to compromise from the beginning. And I think because of the unique leadership of Ada Deer and some others, that's what was done at Menominee. And they set their chart and then were reasonable, backed off it somewhat, but it came very close to what they originally wanted. In an era now when many are critical of some aspects of ANCSA, I think it's important to remember that there were strong elements of that in ANCSA. Alaska Native leaders who worked so hard for ANCSA, in my judgment, were enormously idealistic. They talked amounts of land that no one was willing to consider, and amounts of compensation financially that no one was willing to consider. And so it seems to me that's a crucial part of this commission's work, is to identify what you believe is right, not in a radical sense, but just in a sense that was stated earlier, that Alaska Natives want self-rule. To turn to the Menominee situation, there are just a whole series of parallels between the Menominee termination and ANCSA. Both groups had large holdings of land in a state corporation. The Menominees had over 250,000 acres, which is a large amount in a much smaller state. Alaska Natives here have, of course, a large amount. Most basically, what the Menominees did was to reestablish the full range of the federal relationship. And they were able to reestablish courts without criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians, were able to reestablish their tax-exempt status, and were able to reestablish a central concept of tribalism that has been troubling Alaska Natives, which is that you don't determine tribal membership by means of people who are alive on a certain date and then go to inheritance, as you do with shareholders, but rather a tribal group is one that is constantly expanding and contracting as people pass away and are born, and the Menominees were able to do that. I think what Ralph said earlier, and many people have said earlier, in earlier hearings, is absolutely true, and I endorse it, which is that the vested rights problems here, to the extent they are raised, can be overcome, in my judgment, by Congress. And we could have technical discussions on that, but it seems to me much more important to recognize Congress's broad power, if Alaska Natives decide they wish to remedy it, to remedy the injustice that children born after 1971 have suffered, if I'm correct in phrasing that. I think if Alaska Natives want to remedy that, Congress has the power and there aren't going to be vested rights obstacles. So what the Menominee Act did was to reestablish the federal relationship, all aspects of it. And the Menominees today are in substantially the same situation as tribes in the lower 48 are concerned. What strikes me as important about the Menominee situation, and I do think it most important, is that a whole or partial termination, and Alaska Natives have been partially terminated because of the way in which the federal relationship has been removed in some respects, that can be corrected. But that Congress has enough authority that it can be corrected in a creative way. The Menominees chose one way. What's important is not the way they chose, but the fact that the flexibility is there for your model to be adopted. To just make a brief statement about a matter not involving the Menominees, I really believe that the look you have taken at international matters is of great importance, because when one looks at the international sphere, what one sees is that in almost every nation, Aboriginal people are struggling for self-rule. The fact that the concept of self-rule is not just circumpolar or is not just in the United States, but is literally worldwide, I think attests to the force and dignity of that concept. There is a deep moral component here of Aboriginal people around the world who are simply not willing to let go of that of that ideal. The reaction of other nations has not comported with the ideal. Around the world, we have seen many situations in which Aboriginal movements have not their requests have not been met with legislation granting self-rule. But as I think Professor Johnson's studies and others have shown, the movement has been quite extraordinary because it was a concept that wasn't going anywhere, it seemed, even 15 years ago. But in a number of nations, and China is another one where there are developments, are recognizing to some degree self-rule. I feel that all who deal with this problem must appreciate the depth of that desire for self-rule. I think that natives need to appreciate its force because I think it is your greatest ally other than your own will. I think that those who are not natives who are dealing with this situation must appreciate the impetus and the force of that ideal. And I think that means that for those who wish Alaska Native self-rule well or ill, I think there will be changes here because of the force of that movement and the determination of Alaska Native people. And I believe that if you set your ideals, and you're going to have to back off of them, but if you set your ideals, there's every realistic chance that a fair remedy can be found. And I guess I draw that from my experience with the Menominees and also with the Siletz tribe, and a fascinating situation a couple of years ago with the Texas Band of Kickapoos, who have a reservation in Mexico and in Texas, and legislation was passed in early 1983 by this Congress, and it just seems to me that it is realistic to be impractical as a starting point.
Thank you. Could I just ask you a couple of questions about the Menominee restoration while we're on that subject? As I understand it, the Menominee tribe was terminated in the sense that they ceased to receive any federal aid, and their tribal holdings were turned over to a corporation, and they were all issued shares in the corporation. Those shares were to be transferable, but the day of transferability was postponed a number of times, I believe.
Yes, and interestingly enough, it was postponed by state legislation, Wisconsin state legislation, so that their 1991 date kept getting pushed back by the state, effectively.
The movement to restore the Menominees led to the reestablishment of the tribe, and was the land and the other assets held by the corporation transferred to the tribe?
What's not commonly realized about the Menominee Act, the first piece of legislation by Congress was passed in December 1973. It did not transfer land title. Rather, Congress directed that the tribe negotiate with the Department of Interior to come up with a plan for a transfer. And we spent the next year negotiating a very complex transfer agreement in which these questions of share ownership were resolved. Then the transfer agreement went into effect in early 1975. So, and the transfer, Judge Berger, yes, was from a state corporation with Menominee shareholders, roughly parallel to the Yangtze corporations, back to the Menominee tribe of Wisconsin to be held in trust by the United States. So there was a transfer from one entity to another, much like many here advocate a transfer from, let us say, village corporations to the IRAs. It seems to me it was conceptually the same transfer, and it was approved.
Approved by whom?
The plan in a procedure that might now be subject to constitutional objections under the Chadha decision that came down a year and a half ago, but the provision of the Menominee Restoration Act was that the plan would be negotiated, and the idea was to keep Congress out of these extremely complex issues involving stock ownership. The idea was for Congress to set a broad provision and then have the parties negotiate out the details, a concept that I think will be very important in whatever recommendations you come up with here, because it's so hard for Congress to deal with all of these details. So Interior and the tribe were directed by the Act to come up with a plan, and then the plan was submitted to Congress and would go into effect unless it were disapproved by either House of Congress within 60 days. So we lodged it with Congress. There was no objection from either House of Congress, and it went into effect in 60 days.
During the negotiations, or since, has the whole question of the relationship of the tribe with the state of Wisconsin come up? Was the state a party to those negotiations?
Yes, they were, certainly my view is, and I think this goes without saying, that there just have to be early negotiations with the state. And in the case of the Menominees, the bill we drafted was basically, well, not basically, it was a negotiated settlement with the state ahead of time. And then the state supported the bill as it went through the legislative process. The Menominee people began objecting in the late 60s, but the bill was introduced in February 1972 and was passed on December 22nd, 1973. The bill went through very quickly. There had just been a crisis reached with the Menominees that is somewhat different than the crisis here, in that the state corporation that owned the land was just not viable economically and was almost at the point where it was going to have to keep selling off more land to pay the bills.
That's not altogether removed from what's happening.
I understand that, and all I mean is that isn't the case across the board with all the corporations.
Well, in the end, what was the relationship that the state acknowledged with respect to the Menominee tribe? Where does that sit?
And again, for a basic concept, the Menominees were fit back into the system of federal Indian law with relatively few deviations from the basic federal Indian relationship. And that was thought to be desirable at that time. One advantage of that, of course, is that you have a relatively well-established body of law, and so your tinkering and making modifications can mean that you have a kind of instability because you can't plug into an existing body of law. The Menominees did plug into the existing body of law. The Menominees are now a non-public law 280 tribe. In other words, the state of Wisconsin does not have jurisdiction under public law 280 by an agreement with the state.
And what about, if you're able to answer this, the question of receipt of state funds by the Menominees, that's a matter of some moment in Alaska.
As to whether a separate federally recognized government should receive state funds, the Menominees do receive state funds, and one way in which they receive state funds is that Menominee County has the same boundaries as the Menominee Reservation, so that some state funds go to the county. I would say, and I appreciate, this is an important philosophical issue, obviously. It seems to me what the federal-Indian relationship has always been is a measured separatism, in that the tribes are largely separate from state law, but the treaties and implementing statutes have provided for some federal support and indeed some state support. That is a relationship that remains somewhat controversial in the lower 48 states, but I think is generally accepted. It seems to me that since under the federal-Indian relationship, federal-tribal relationship, a tribe is not truly separate, and there is some state jurisdiction in there, and they remain state citizens, and they are not foreign nations, it seems to me consistent with that that some state support can fairly be provided. But I realize that issue will always be controversial to some degree.
Yeah. Tony Vesca.
Thank you. My only familiarity with the Menominee case is through the work of Dr. George Spindler, who's an anthropologist. But basically, what he states in terms of the economics of not only the Menominee tribe and its relation to the federal and state governments, but he identifies the Menominee County prior to the termination of the tribe, if that's a way to put it, he puts it that way, as being one of the richest counties in Wisconsin, and years after that termination, where the Menominee tribe had to be like every other county, it became one of the poorest. Do you have any comment on the economic conditions of that and why the economic conditions took a downfall?
Afterwards? Well, the reason is that the federal support was withdrawn. And with the budget adjustments in Washington, you are getting a different financial flow in Indian country on federally recognized Indian reservations than was the case a few years ago. Nonetheless, most studies that have been done reach the result you suggest, which is that Indian reservations are not drains on the state, but in fact, there is sufficient federal support that the demands on the state are minor, or indeed are a benefit. This is a matter which I don't know if this has been done, but at some point it would probably be good basic data under current economic conditions to have an analysis made. And again, I'm not suggesting, I'm here to listen on this issue, so I'm not suggesting that we should have a reservation system in the villages. I'm not suggesting that. But it seems to me you should obtain that data. You should determine what the cash flow difference would be if we take a hypothetical question, which is that all or a certain percentage of village corporation land were transferred to IRAs and the land were taken into trust, and make an analysis of the cash flow to see what the burden on the state would be. I have done that in regard to three states now and tribes I've represented, the state of Oregon with the Siletz, the state of Wisconsin with the Menominees, and the state of Texas with the Texas Kickapoo. Each of those states was very satisfied with the result and found that the economic situation from the state's point of view was improved as a result of having federal trust land within the state. And other studies have reached that result too. But you could have, I think, a very productive cooperative study of some kind done with, and maybe the governor's task force is working on this, but with representatives from the state and natives and the federal government to come up with an estimate of cash flow.
Yeah. Spud Williams?
I think that's already been done in the state, but this state is so short-sighted and they got such knee-jerk reaction against any type of native entities being maintained in the state that they're willing to forego that economic consideration, especially in time is of wealth that this state has. I mean, the schools alone is going to be millions and millions of dollars of drained state revenue, you know, through forever now with the position the state is taking. The social service functions of the federal government and Alaska Natives. No problem. Go ahead. We'll fund it. I mean, this has been the state's position. They're very, very short-sighted, been shooting themselves in the foot because they think they're overly wealthy. And they're assuming these functions, despite the long-range advantages of maintaining Native sovereignties and jurisdictions in the state.
Lesson from my experience is, and I can understand that, and I can see that happening here. At the same time, one of the great advantages you have from a prolonged deliberative process such as this, coupled with the governor's task force, is that you are building a record. And there are, let's say, 10 sets of concerns among Alaska state government officials and citizens at large. And by taking the time to do the spade work and meet those concerns, there is a chance over time that those kind of attitudes can dissipate. And for example, there are green eyeshade people in this state government who collect taxes, and people in the education department. And my sense is that without making it sound too easy, that over time, if these studies are done, that those objections begin slowly to dissipate, issue by issue.
Just before we move on to Reed Chambers and David Getchies, could I just ask you a question about, and to Bob Arnold, a question about the presentation that David Case made. There is only one Indian reservation in Alaska. If instead of creating reservations, the native corporate land at the village level, let's leave the regions out of this for the moment, were to be transferred to the IRAs and they were to hold it. David says they would, because of sovereign immunity, be not be liable to pay taxes and so on, and the IRA government could exercise jurisdiction over that land. Is that so that you would achieve
some of the same results?
Some of the same results, but you wouldn't have a reservation. Does that proposition make sense to you?
First of all, I think the state's going to litigate that proposition, and I don't pretend to know who's going to win, but I think your result is going to be by the Supreme Court of Alaska or in federal court. And David recognizes that those are very close questions as to whether that land would be taxable. I agree there's a good argument for the natives. So I wouldn't be willing. I mean, I just think a court's going to decide that, and there's a good argument for the natives. My general sense would be that if that result is to be reached, you shouldn't omit the possibility of trying to reach that result by federal or state legislation, because that would settle it. And when you have a legislative settlement, you can build in a kind of flexibility that you never can in a court case. So, and again, I'm from the lower 48, and I in no sense am trying to tell people what this legislature would do. I hope that's just obvious. But I sure hope you don't rule it out. I think that there are possibilities there, that building goodwill over time, there is a flexibility there and in Congress that is greater than with litigation.
Yeah. Charlie Edwardson, you had your hand up. Why don't you move up and take a seat at the round table and we will. But before we come to you, Charlie, some other people had their hand up. I wonder, we've got a few minutes. Reed Chambers, did you want to add to that?
Well, I just wanted to add to it the complementary perspective. The odd thing is, according to what Charlie's saying and what Spud's saying, the odd thing is that the state of Alaska obviously maintains a government relations office in Washington,
and its senators and congressmen are all the time trying to get federal projects located here in Alaska. I mean, it's a Washington political game called the pork barrel process. And if anyone was talking about establishing, let's say, a military installation in Alaska or something like that, why the governor's office in Washington and the senators and the congressman would be falling all over themselves to get it done. And that gets federal dollars into the state, and it's real important. I think what Charlie's saying is absolutely right. Charles Wilkinson's saying is that the if you get a federal Indian establishment in Alaska, you get exactly the same process going, and you have that going now, and you don't want to lose that. I mean, the state should be in the state's enlightened interest not to lose that it's in Maine, for example. I represent one of the tribes in Maine, the Holton Band of Maliseets, and the state resisted, for when we were negotiating to settle the Maine land claims, resisted having the Holton Band of Maliseets recognized as a federal Indian tribe. But the state now supports that because into the town of Holton you have a large number of federal dollars coming for welfare payments and that the state is no longer responsible for, and federal contracts getting set up under the Johnson O'Malley program and the Indian Self-Determination Act. And I mean, I don't know whether it's $1 million or $3 million, but there's a good deal of federal money coming into the town of Holton, Maine, that wasn't there 5 years ago, and so it is something that once you get past the knee-jerk kind of resistance, that is something that I think state legislators and state executive officials tend to come see that it is in their interest.
Yeah. This afternoon, perhaps we could ask you, Reed, and I think Lawrence Assenbrenner, you were both connected with that Maine settlement, and that's the most recent land claim settlement in the United States. And this afternoon, perhaps you might tell us how they sorted out these questions of state-tribal relations and taxation and so on in the Maine settlement. David Getchies and then Bob Arnold.
Thank you, Judge Berger, and thank you for inviting me. I'm pleased to be back in Alaska and privileged to be part of this commission's work. I want to pursue this same issue that we've been looking at, and that is the practicality, if you will, of some kind of restoration legislation that we've leapt into from David Case's paper, and we've kind of left the Home Rule Village for a minute. But I'm intrigued by this notion that I agree with, that Charles Wilkinson said, that you really ought to start with what you'd ideally like to have in terms of restoration, and then work back from there, that a lot more may be practical than one thinks. If you look at what really was terminated in the Menominee case and compare it to what's been terminated by the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, much less has been terminated by the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. You've terminated the act in Section 4 terminates rights in land, aboriginal claims, and claims against the federal government predating the act, but it does not terminate sovereignty of the native organization or the comparable organizations to tribes in Alaska, nor does it terminate a trusteeship relationship with the federal government. Now, if you're looking at state opposition, public opposition, I'd like to ask first Charles and then people from Alaska, particularly I understand there's some legislators here and people who deal with state government a great deal. First Charles, as the attorney who successfully represented the Menominees in their restoration battle, would one expect less state opposition as a result of the fact that we already have sovereign status that's been unextinguished of Native people in Alaska, and we all already have a continuing trust relationship? There's less to restore. Should we expect less opposition?
I feel as though I'd be guessing on that in Alaska, so I will beg
well,
off on
I, well,
that.
Well, I don't think you should talk about Alaska, but what about in Wisconsin? Was the state of Wisconsin more concerned about the fact that land would be removed from the tax rolls, or were they more concerned that there would be another sovereign in their midst?
In Wisconsin, Oregon, Texas, and Utah, the places I've dealt most specifically with in restoration, in each case there was virulent opposition to any increased sovereignty, as there is here. Over time, it faded as the spade work was done. I'm just not going to take it further. I don't feel comfortable with saying whether it's going to be easier here or not. I guess I happen to believe it can be done. I think Alaska Natives have a set of human resources that are in excess of any Indian group in the United States, except maybe the Navajos. I think there isn't much that they can't accomplish as a group, and so I would expect that they could achieve that. But whether it's easier than in the other states, I guess I don't feel quite as comfortable.
But the burr under the saddle in these other states was
very similar.
Was related to sovereignty, not just the land being restored to tribal ownership.
Well, one burr under the saddle, which is a small percentage of the population, but is just there, is just racism against Indian people, and that's one burr under the saddle. Then, yes, and that you ultimately can't deal with, and enlightened state legislators recognize that. I think they start getting mail, and then months later they realize that is an irrational response and they can't deal with it. But then, yes, there is just opposition to sovereignty. But here you're going to have hunting and fishing issues that, of course, are almost a separate question that would have to be resolved. And then there's a separate philosophical question, which is just separate status. We're an egalitarian nation, and it really isn't sovereignty so much, it's just why should we single out any group? And that has to be overcome.
Bob Arnold, would you like to make any observations on this?
I feel as though I have an undisturbed distinction because I'm leaving early. I'm not sure I have anything profound to say. I feel that I kind of lack the cumulative experience of those who have participated in earlier sessions and found myself somewhat puzzled arriving here this late in the work of the Berger Commission to see clearly what objectives would be served by the title given to today's session. For instance, the use of the conjunction and between land and governance made me, and of course is a word that doesn't tell much about the relationship between the two words. I know from reading about the work of the Berger Commission that certainly central to the discussions is the preservation of land base, and so made that connection for myself. But I think there are other objectives that have to do with governance that have not been fully spelled out yet, and it would be beneficial to see them spelled out in the course of 4 days. For instance, if an objective is self-rule to the exclusion of state oversight, it's very important to kind of say that, because otherwise the solutions are hard to find. Incidentally, speaking of the state, though I work for the state, I do not speak for the state on matters related here. Indeed, I'm not even a member of the Sovereignty Task Force. Speaking of today's issue, however, in terms of preservation of land base, I believe that Native corporations are in varying stages face varying degrees of jeopardy with regard to the loss of lands. And honest persons might disagree how much jeopardy there is, say, from the standpoint of taxation. For most Native corporation lands lie outside of taxing jurisdictions. There seems to be as great a concern over the decisions of shareholders to allow land to be sold, or perhaps to allow their stock to be sold, which would obtain the control of land. Both David Case and Professor Johnson spoke of alternatives. Professor Johnson spoke of alternative approaches. David Case talked of the distinction that he had made between large communities, which can win first-class status and have home rule powers, and the small villages. My view, I think, is that it's hard to anticipate a kind of global solution because the situation of communities, native communities in the state, not only varies with regard to the jeopardy that they face with regard to the lands, but also in the situations and the impulses that animate the people of those places. And to this point in the discussion, I am led to the conclusion that a variety of approaches from which native communities might choose is perhaps what should be sought. For instance, the Federal Land Bank exists now, but exists in name in that it hasn't been enacted. At the state level, we have been discussing a state land bank, which might have some variant form, though following the federal model, and perhaps other kinds. And for some corporations, given the impulses that animate their members, perhaps the land bank will do. So I know that legislators and congressmen, just as an observer, like to find unanimity in the community that is seeking the legislation, and perhaps it's useful to think of alternative approaches, not one over against the other, but alternative approaches from which native communities might select that scheme that is built.